All right, here we are. How about this space? Hey, this is pretty cool. This is awesome to be here. Hi again, everyone, and welcome. We'd like to thank Carolyn Markey and GM for opening this up to us tonight. Now I'd like to introduce Kevin Kerbitz of GM. He gave me his card before we came out here, and it says, Head Custodian, Chief Storyteller, and Keeper of the Flame. So I'm guessing this fella likes cars. So he's going to say a few quick words about the history of the building and the small museum it houses.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to be here, and thank you all for joining us here in Flint and joining us at Factory One. The building that you're in, we consider the birthplace of General Motors. Now, that doesn't mean that the Articles of Incorporation were signed here, but rather this is where the business started. See, back in 1886, a couple of young men in their 20s were working in Flint, one by the name of William Crapo Durant, who was an insurance salesman in town, and his friend J. Dallas Dort, who was a clerk at a hardware store. Now, this unlikely duo invested in a patent. They bought a patent for a road cart, patented suspension, bought the tooling, bought the equipment, and moved it from Coldwater, Michigan to Flint. Very much like the one that's behind me, little two-wheeled road cart with a sprung seat. They started manufacturing those carts, in this building in 1887. That business from this unlikely partnership of a couple of guys in their mid-20s that had no manufacturing experience, they built that business into the largest carriage manufacturer in the country, possibly the world. By the turn of the century, 1900, they were turning out tens of thousands of carts, not just road carts, four-wheeled carts, different models, different brands, different colors, different makes for different markets across the country and in Canada. In 1904, a company started making cars in Flint called Buick. And the owners of Buick, the Flint Wagon Works, a competitor of Durant Dort, wanted somebody else to run the business, somebody that was a little more business savvy. And they asked Billy Durant to come and run that. He was kind of semi-retired from the carriage business, working in New York at the time, living in New York. But he came back to Flint, didn't really like cars, but he liked the Buick. And he went into production, building the Buick using Durant Dort resources, Durant Dort factories, Durant Dort assets in Jackson, Michigan, before moving back to Flint. That was in 1905. By 1908, Durant had turned Buick into the highest volume vehicle in the country. There were more Buicks built than Ford, more than Cadillac, more than Oldsmobile, and on that success, Durant founded General Motors on September 16th, 1908, and the business continued to grow. Years later, Durant looked back on this factory, this very factory, and said that he could trace all of his business enterprises to this building where he started in 1887 manufacturing two-wheeled personal transportation vehicles, horse-drawn. So we're very fortunate that the building has survived. A few years ago, 2013, General Motors bought the building. We took the next 4 years to do a complete restoration. Gutted all the mechanicals, restored everything to the way that you see it today, turned it into not a museum. We don't want to be that. We want to be a living, breathing entity contributing to the future. So we have this great conference space in here for events such as this, company events, civic events, community events. We have a wonderful archive that's run by Kettering University, just across the hall, you passed it when you came in, that has a tremendous amount of information that traces the beginnings of the auto industry, of the carriage industry here in Flint and around the globe. And then we have some office space upstairs that we kind of like to keep to ourselves, but if you do have an opportunity, if we've got some people that can show you around, you're welcome to take a look up there as well. But again, I just want to welcome you to Flint. Welcome to Factory One, the birthplace of General Motors. And I will now turn it over to... Okay, thank you.
Thank you, John. Turned off. Thanks very much, Kevin. Really appreciate your hospitality here and the storytelling as well. Now it's time to introduce our moderator for this evening's plenary, Jim Motivalli. Jim is a longtime SEJ member and a fabled automotive journalist and author. He tells me that his first car was a Chevy Nova. So
convertible.
A convertible. Oh. And he's a man who often gives people a lot of advice on which kind of cars to buy, and just has really encyclopedic knowledge of many different cars and car issues. So we're very pleased to have him moderating the session tonight. Thank you, Jim.
I'm just going to start by talking a couple of interesting aspects of, we're talking about the future of cars here, and this building has a number of interesting ways of looking at the future of the car. We have some of the first automobiles that are here in the room with us, and then outside we have the Chevy Bolt, which represents the future of the automobile. If you're going to be with us through Friday, on Friday that car will be available for ride and drive experiences. I hope you take advantage of that because it's a very fast car and it's very quiet, it's very fun to drive, and it's GM's commitment to an all-electric future. What's interesting is, as has been mentioned, the archives of Charles Kettering are here in the building, and Charles Kettering has two great distinctions that we can mention here. One is that he invented the self-starter for automobiles, and that meant you didn't have to crank your gasoline car. That one invention did more to kill the electric car at that time than any other. Whether you could look at that as a positive or negative, if certainly the march of progress, the self-starter saved a lot of people from getting hurt by those cranks. And Charles Kettering is also the guy who put lead in gasoline, so he was quite an innovative. he was quite an innovator in the field of the automobile. But I wanted to point out another thing. We were talking about how General Motors got started with Buick, and Buick today is a very interesting entity. General Motors sells more Buicks in China than it does in the United States. And that shows you what has happened to the auto industry, maybe where the auto industry is going. China is the most biggest auto market now. It's bigger than the United States market, and it's the fastest growing market. It's also the country that has done the most to introduce electric cars. And I've been there twice recently, and I've seen at the auto shows, every stand has electric vehicles on it. So they are very committed to the future of the car. So what we're going to talk about tonight is where the auto industry is going, where the car will go, but also car culture a little bit, like how that's going to change. The future of the car is autonomous, electric, and connected. It's those three things. And what's really important is if these future cars are privately owned or shared. If they are shared, they can be a real environmental boon. The auto companies are looking at sort of moving from becoming strict manufacturers of cars to becoming auto mobility companies. In fact, they talk about it that way. All the automakers are creating share companies. If automobiles are shared, we will probably have a much smaller car fleet globally. Without sharing, we're probably looking at 2 billion cars on the planet. With sharing, we have the opportunity to reduce the car fleet by 40 to 50%. And large parts of cities in particular can be repurposed away from automobiles to other uses. Like the same way the Big Dig took 30 acres of land and created a park in the center of Boston. That could happen in other places as well. We're looking at the end of the parking garage, as we know it, the end of the parking lot, the end of the driveway in the suburban home. A lot of different things like that are possible if cars are shared. Right now, cars sit 95% of the time and are used 5% of the time. The rest of the time, we have to store them somewhere. And that was why we devote, in some cities, 40 to 50% of our land area to cars. So we're not talking about getting rid of cars. We're talking about repurposing them in, I think, is a very possible way. This is only one possible future I'm talking about, because we could do other things. I'm working on a book that's about this future and how it might play out. But it's really quite interesting. And that's why we called the panel together and what we're going to talk about over the next hour. Actually, we have an hour and a half if you people want to stay with me, but if you guys look tired, we'll probably shut it down early. But I have a very exciting panel. We've all had a lot of expertise in this area. We're going to start with Mike Abelson. He's Vice President of Global Strategy for General Motors, the company who started in this building. So we're going to just have short statements from the three speakers, and then we're going to open it up into a general discussion, and we want it to be very interactive. So think about the questions you might have, because we'll get to the questions fairly soon. We're not just going to talk amongst ourselves for long. So, Mike, talk about the future of the car. Where are we going?
It's a fascinating topic, and Jim, I think you did a great job of outlining it. And I think it's ironic to talk about the future of the car in this building, especially as an employee of General Motors, because we firmly believe our industry is going to get disrupted soon. And it's going to get disrupted by some of the trends that Jim talked about. And I would put forth, I don't think our industry has seen as much disruption as we will here in the next few years since the days that we were moving from making carriages to making horseless carriages. And so Jim did a great job of talking about what those four trends are that are so important and so disruptive to the industry: connectivity, autonomous sharing, and electrification. So let me give you a quick rundown of where we are as a company in those four areas. Electrification, Jim very kindly mentioned the Chevy Bolt, 238 miles of range. And I think people don't understand, they don't think about how far do they drive in a day. So I'll give you my experience today. I left work north of Detroit, drove an hour and a half to get here. I will drive an hour to get home. And when I get home, I'll still have 120 miles of range on the Chevy Bolt I'm driving today. So a vehicle that's been available for less than $30,000, including the federal tax credit, and has been in production for over a year and a half now. So that's electrification. Connectivity. As cars become parts of the Internet of Things, the car is one of the most sophisticated machines you interface with during your daily life. At General Motors, we saw this quite a few years ago. We've had OnStar now for over 20 years. We have as many 4G LTE connected vehicles, more than the rest of the industry combined. So connectivity we have seen as a very important force. Sharing, to Jim's point, is a brand new business model. Ever since we moved to horseless carriages, we've had this same business model of selling vehicles to private individuals for their own use. This idea of sharing, of transportation as a service, is a very different way to think about the business. Again, to Jim's point, we started Maven, a car sharing brand, 2.5 years ago. And in fact, now we've started to deploy electric vehicles into that car sharing brand. We have over 23 million all electric miles in Maven. We have over 900 vehicles deployed. And so the combination of sharing and electrification leads you to much higher utilization of these electric vehicles than you would see in the retail space. And then finally, sort of the most talked about item in the automotive industry lately is autonomous. It's an area that General Motors has put a lot of effort, a very significant number of resources. We've said we intend to deploy an autonomous, truly driverless vehicle in a ride-sharing service, an electric vehicle, next year in 2019. So you can see in that business concept all these trends come together: connectivity, sharing, electrification, and autonomous. But that's just where we are. And if you're in an industry that's going to get disrupted, as important as where you are is where you're going to go. And so at General Motors, we try and put the customer in the center of everything we do. A couple of years ago, we started thinking about what does the future transportation system look like? What do our customers want from that transportation system? And after we thought about it for a while, we figured out we could summarize it pretty easily. And it's now our vision for the future of transportation. It is zero emissions, zero crashes, and zero congestion. If we can deliver a transportation system that achieves those goals, I think that's what a customer really wants in the future from transportation. So our CEO, Mary Barra, last year publicly committed us as a company to that vision, and it's a vision we continue to work towards as we continue to wrestle with the impact of all these disruptive forces on the industry. So that's the 5-minute or less version of where General Motors is right now.
Yeah, it's a big period of change. As we're saying, it's akin to when we switched from horses to horseless carriages, except what we're doing now is a little bit different because you own the horse and you own the horseless carriage. Now we're talking about not owning the entity. We're sharing it. Big change. Our next speaker is John DiCicco. He's a research professor at the University of Michigan Energy Institute and director, University of Michigan Energy Survey. He had something to do with the M-City. Some of you are going to be in the tour. We're going to look at the self-driving facilities tomorrow, and John was in on the planning on that. He's here in Ann Arbor. So what do you see from your perspective? You've been in this field a long time, as long as I have, so tell us where we are.
Sure, Jim. It's great to be here. You know, I'm not that into the vision thing. I'm sort of more of a process person, and as someone who, before I came back to the ivory tower a few years ago, spent my career working on environmental policy. Some of your colleagues, many of your retired colleagues, know me from the cafe battles, which continue. And working on the environmental angle gives me, I think, a different perspective on this. I think about the future of the car in terms of, I'd say, five dimensions that are going to shape it from an environmental perspective. And some of those are ones we've heard about. But number one is the number of vehicles. It's 1 billion now globally. The projections, conventional projections, not factoring in what might happen with mobility automation, see that going to 2 billion by mid-century, and 2 billion cars are going to rack up many trillions of miles. Next dimension is fuel efficiency. That matters whether a car is electric, but it matters a lot when it's burning a hydrocarbon, which is still mostly what's happening. The next two dimensions are automation, which in my mind encompasses the connectivity plus the autonomous or driverless components. I see them together as what's going to automate mobility and electrification. And then the fifth is carbon offsets. And I know, okay, what do I mean? Well, I'll explain that in a little bit. But let me hit on some of these others of the five first. Well, the number of cars is obviously critical in terms of the environmental impacts. And I think whether we have a vision of shared mobility where the number of cars decreases and we move away from private ownership and you have mobility as a service, they become utilitarian appliances that move us around, is possible. But that and we can get into it more later, that undermines the business model for transportation as the world knows it. Because the largest capital cost of our transportation system is the cost of the vehicles themselves, which private customers willingly pony up. So there's a very different business model. Transit and non-private ownership always struggles. So that's something to think about. fuel efficiency. Even if we make rapid progress on electrification, we're going to be still burning vast quantities of liquid fuels for many decades. So that environmental impact and fuel economy matters a lot, and what we do on fuel economy will in turn, as a society, will in turn shape the cars. In terms of electrification, I think everyone knows sort of the main issues there. We have cost, we have capacity limitations, capability limitations of the vehicle. One of my cars is a Chevy Silverado. We're a long time away from replicating its full functionality with a pure plug-in vehicle in terms of capabilities. We have the charging challenges, we have other barriers. So there's a real question in my mind whether electrification is going to be a revolution as people see it, a disruptive revolution, or whether it's going to be an evolutionary change that plays out over time, and we don't know to what extent it'll even play out over time. Automation is the real wild card. I'm not going to elaborate on that. I think we'll all get into that. But what I really want to emphasize is that from an environmental vantage point, at this point, it's very unclear whether that's a net positive or a net negative. The positive vision gets a lot of airplay. That certainly doesn't jive with anything of my experience working on these issues in terms of what the market does and what customers end up valuing. Automated, electrified, Barca loungers on wheels, anyone with big screen TVs driving you autonomously from even farther distances? I don't know. Now, the last one, carbon offsets, what's going on? Well, that relates to the fact that we're going to be burning a lot of liquid fuel for a long time. There's no such thing as a low carbon fuel. That gets a lot of airplay too. That's a myth. If you burn liquid fuel, you put CO2 into the air. To mitigate that, the only thing you can do is speed up the rate at which you remove CO2 from the air somewhere else. We call that an offset. That's going to factor in because if society really truly gets serious about climate, which we've not done yet, and really tries to do something about it, that's going to be essential low-hanging fruit. Economically, it will actually prolong economically the life of liquid fuels. Some people may think that's horrible, but if that's speeding up climate mitigation, it's certainly not from the planet's point of view. So we don't need to get into that any more than you want to, but I think that's a sleeper factor as well. So really, that's it. You know, in terms of the five things I think of are the number of vehicles, their fuel efficiency, electrification, automation, and offsets, which means relates to how serious we really are going to be about the climate problem. Thanks.
Okay. Well, our third speaker is Michelle Krebs. She's a longtime environmental writer and automotive writer for the New York Times and other publications. She's an executive analyst these days with Auto Trader and a former senior auto analyst and editor at Edmunds.com, one of the primary sources I go to for auto analysis and expert opinion. So she is now a prognosticator, and what are you prognosticating these days?
Well, first of all, my heart is still as a journalist, so, you know, I appreciate greatly what you do. Now I'm an analyst for Cox Automotive. Let me tell you a little bit about Cox, because we are being disrupted, just as General Motors is. You may know Cox for Cox Cable if you're on the West Coast. an industry being disrupted. We own newspapers, Atlanta Journal-Constitution, the Dayton Daily News. We own radio stations, TV. All of those businesses are being disrupted. And now we have Cox Automotive. We have Auto Trader and Kelley Blue Book, which are our car shopping websites. And then we have what's Manheim Auto Auctions, where dealers go to buy and sell used vehicles. So we have invested a lot in the current structure of the auto industry. So we spent a lot of time rethinking what we're going to do. And we like everybody else, are moving towards a future of new mobility. We're spending a lot of time looking at new ways of acquiring transportation. I think what we bring to the party is we know a lot about consumers because consumers, millions, come to our websites every month and we see how they shop and we do a lot of studies on them and the surveys. And in fact, the recent one we did a mobility services study where we looked at their consumer views on autonomous vehicles and then their consumer views of things like car sharing, ride hailing, and then the newest thing, subscription services. So on the autonomous side, it was interesting. We did this study 2 years ago, and people were euphoric about it, if they were aware at all. What we have seen now is they are much more aware of autonomous vehicles, a little more skeptical. The Uber accident in Phoenix, where a woman was killed, really caused people to take pause. So I think we all have a lot of work to do to educate people about what autonomous vehicles are, what they do, what they don't do, give people the experience in cars that have systems that move us towards autonomous vehicles, like the cruise system on the Cadillacs. And we have to prove to them that there's an enhancement in their life, and safety is one of the biggest ones. So we have a lot of work to do in that regard. We think that the future is a sharing future. We think that by 2023, 2025 is an inflection point for less personal ownership and more fleet ownership of vehicles like autonomous vehicles. That changes our world a lot. So we are experimenting with things like subscription services where you pay a monthly fee and you have access to different vehicles. We do it with used vehicles. We're playing with a lot of business models to get experience, and we're providing systems that help other companies enable those kinds of things because the model has to change of how we acquire transportation. So it's a very disruptive world with lots of change.
I'm writing a book on the future of cars, but the crystal ball remains a little bit murky in the sense of the timetable of it. And people hate to be pinned down on exactly what that timetable is. You can be proven quite wrong about things like that. So I'm going to ask my panelists and pin them down and get them to commit to what they think is the timeline. I mean, maybe we can look at this different ways, like timeline to full electrification, timeline to a sharing model, timeline to full autonomy. Start with you, Mike. Do you have, does GM
officially? All of those?
All of those, yeah. Or maybe you don't think all of those are going to happen. So
you remind me if I miss one, please. But let's start with autonomy. So this system, the Cruise autonomous vehicle deployed next year that I referenced, is what we call a level 4 autonomous system, which means it's driverless within a certain domain. And the domain that we use in this case, since we're going to be running a ride-sharing fleet, is it'll operate within a certain city. It won't necessarily operate, at least initially, under all weather conditions. And that's the domain that it'll be driverless in. When you talk about a retail customer and fully autonomous so that it can drive anywhere a human being can drive today, that's going to be a little bit further out.
Isn't one of the problems is that when people hear autonomous, they instantly think of sitting in the back of the car playing with their phone. And that's the hardest part, to get to that part. We have a lot of steps before that.
I mean, this level four system next year will be driverless. You won't have nobody. In fact, we've already shown the vehicle without a steering wheel and without pedals. But to your point, I think then enabling that to handle everything a human driver handles, it's perhaps not surprising that some of the same conditions that cause anxiety with human drivers as far as bad weather and so on are more difficult technically, and so it'll take a little while to solve those challenges. Electrification, I think to John's point, there are going to be certain classes of vehicle that take longer to get fully electrified than others. At General Motors, we think both battery electric vehicles and fuel cell electric vehicles have a future, because there are certain types of vehicles and certain uses for vehicles that just don't lend themselves very well to batteries. Batteries are great because you can take energy out, you can put energy back in. So if you're in stop and go city driving, they're fabulous. If you're trying to drive all day down the highway, they're not so good at that, because the amount of energy you can store just isn't as high as some of the other things like a hydrogen fuel cell. So electrification, I think actually sharing these high utilization fleets, one of the advantages of electrified vehicles is they have a lower operating cost. And so when you run these fleets of vehicles and you start doing the economics, it turns out the economics favor an electric vehicle because of the lower ongoing operating costs. So we think that's going to be an area that fully electrified vehicles roll out very naturally. And we've said as a company, in fact, that all AVs will be EVs in General Motors. And then you had one more. Was it sharing?
Sharing.
So sharing, I think you'll see the impact first, and you'll see it, you're already seeing it, inside of dense urban environments. Sharing very much depends on what is the ride density you can get, and the business depends on that. As you get into less and less dense environments, it gets much tougher economically to make a sharing service work. And so I honestly think there'll be areas, rural areas, where sharing isn't going to work for a long, long time, or may never work. Just to think about it, ride-sharing services today will tell you people want to wait about 3 minutes before the ride shows up. They don't like to wait longer than that. Well, if you're out in a rural environment and it's 3 minutes between your house and your neighbor's house, it's pretty hard to run a ride-sharing service in that sort of density. So again, it'll happen quickly in cities, not so quickly in some of the other areas.
So, Michelle, you don't have to answer all three of these, but I know Cox does a lot of planning. Do you project specific dates for some of these things?
Well, we do think that, you know, in terms of the car sharing, mid-next decade, we'll see an inflection point. And to Mike's point, it won't be the same everywhere. It'll be in urban areas. It'll be driven by young people because they are much more accepting of that. Think about households that typically have two cars, three cars. Sharing allows them to maybe have one family car and do sharing with their other needs for transportation.
So that means it's sort of gradual.
I think it's going to be phased. I think it's good, you know, we're going to see autonomous in geofenced areas or in specific places. We're going to see sharing in more urban places, and it's not going to be the same global either. Each country has
it. When I talk to auto executives, I ask about this whole idea of private ownership. They say, "Well, people like to have their stuff in the car." You know?
That's the big trick, though.
The coffee mug and the.
But I think to your point, what's fascinating when you think about sharing going forward is this idea of peer-to-peer sharing, where you may own a car and choose to make it available in a sharing service. So our Maven, our car sharing brand, recently introduced a peer-to-peer option.
Right. That's personal car sharing, that's
yeah.
Also called.
So you may own a car, but you may also share that car that you own.
John, are there any of these areas that you think aren't going to happen?
Well, you know, in terms of when things happen, I think full automation is the nut that has to be cracked before we really see some of these other things fully play out. I think, you know, even though say in the short run, it makes sense that your automated vehicles, level fours, are going to be electrified. Certainly makes a lot of sense. I think automation is actually going to be essential to really let electrification diffuse. Mm-hmm. You know, cars can then charge themselves and probably wirelessly and things like that. So automation will help address some of the current barriers to electrification and also help address the different inherently different capabilities of battery cars that are going to persist for a long time. So then I do not believe that we can think about this as the car. The car is a 19th century concept that thrived, came to its own and thrived during the 20th century, and it's what we know now. In the 60s, Daniel Bell wrote a book called The Post-Mobility, The Coming Age of Post-Mobility. Some of us know that. And it was about how information technology would be broadly transformative of society. It was kind of a sociological work. It was very dense. I couldn't even get through the whole thing, but he had a nice summary up front. The automobile, ironically, is the one area, transportation is the one area that is at this point least touched by the information revolution.
That's a really interesting point.
And when it happens, the change will be more profound. It will be not just the car, it will be a new ecosystem of mobility and accessibility that will have to co-evolve with new landscapes, with new ways we even use buildings. And I think it's entirely unpredictable, but I'm intrigued by some of the experiments that, like, China has. I can't remember the name of it because I've never been there and don't know Chinese, but there's outside of Beijing, they're creating a special city, right? Do you know the name of that?
I don't remember the name, but I know.
Right, and it's not just about transportation, but automated transportation is part of it. So they're rethinking how a city should be using 21st century technology. Because I think I think if we just try to think of the car, the 19th century car, artificial intelligence is not up to the capability to do level five. I just don't believe that it is. But with connectivity and rethinking the landscape and rethinking the relationships, we could have an automated mobility system. So that will, I can't put a timeline on it. I have a feeling, though, it's going to play out with intense creativity and dedication, with less litigious barriers somewhere in Asia, where they're just going to do like what Robert Moses did, but now with 21st century capability, it will be demonstrated and then diffuse across the world.
And of course, China has a huge motivation because, as I mentioned, I've been there recently, and the traffic congestion is orders of magnitude worse than anything you've seen in Los Angeles or Detroit or New York. It's just amazing. And the smog that associated with that is equally appalling.
And they don't have much oil. So they're intensely motivated, as well as an industrial policy.
Right, and they have a command economy.
They can make it happen. Command and control, that's a wonderful thing.
Okay, so we're going to get to your...
Can I
go ahead?
Yeah. I agree on electrification. China is very aggressive. Autonomous driving. I think the U.S. is in the lead globally right now. And I think, honestly, a lot of the economics around making autonomous driving as a service work depend on how much do you have to pay a human driver. Mm-hmm. It's a very different equation in China than it is here. So mm-hmm. I agree with a lot of the points fundamentally on what China can do and the way that they operate. But I do think, at least so far, the U.S. is in the lead in autonomous.
We're going to get to your questions in just a minute, but I wanted to bring up one other aspect of this I think is fascinating. Some of you may have heard of Bob Lutz, who was actually vice chairman of General Motors.
I've heard of him, yeah.
You've heard of Bob Lutz. Well, he's now an auto columnist. He's joined our ranks. He's a journalist now. He actually led almost every auto company in the world at one point, but he has a tendency to get sent packing at various points because he's very outspoken. And he has recently predicted, I interviewed him recently, and he believes that car branding will go away. In other words, you won't buy a Chevy or a Mercedes or a BMW. Instead, you won't buy a car at all, and you'll just have the car come pick you up, and it won't necessarily be any brand, like a train. I mean, did you know what, if you came here by plane, do you know what brand of plane it was? Did it matter to you? Or if when you get in a train, do you know if it's a Bombardier or whatever? Probably don't know. And it may not matter as much with cars. And Lutz predicted that in something like 7 or 8 years, branding will actually go away. So just before we get to your questions, I just throw it out to the panel. Is that feasible? It's hard to imagine General Motors without the General Motors brand, but it is actually possible.
So to your point, if you imagine transportation as a service, where you're buying the service, you're not buying the physical machine, the brand of the machine becomes less important. All that being said, we think personal ownership is going to survive for a long, long time.
Well, how much? I'm big on putting dates on these things.
I'm happy to say in my lifetime, personal ownership will still be significant. And part of that,
you again?
Part of that is this,
us, Jim.
Part of that is this density, but part of it is when you talk to people about the idea of owning an autonomous vehicle, there are a lot of people very interested in that. And so, like a lot of things, I can agree with Bob up to a point. In
this is why he was never the head of General Motors.
He was very close.
Very close.
So, but I think brands will be around for quite some time.
But I think we'll have another way to look at it. I think we will have a rise in brands of mobility as a service. I mean, in the way,
right?
You know, that we, as you said, airlines. We don't know who made the plane, but we know the airlines.
Right.
They can
brand
differentiate
could be
themselves.
Maven. Right.
Exactly.
By the quality of service.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uber and Lyft are a very current example of exactly your point.
And those are incredibly well-known brands now already.
And that business aspect has got to be something you guys are thinking about.
Well, asked the question, who would you want to acquire your autonomous transportation from? Mm-hmm. And it was pretty much everybody's in play. And it may be a tech company. It may be an automotive company. It may be something altogether different. So.
Yeah, but don't you think
a lot of brand loyalty.
So far the tech companies have talked a good game about building cars and they found it's a bit harder than they thought it was going to be?
Oh, yeah, they have. And that's why we're seeing bridges between Silicon Valley and traditional automaking places.
You know, how many auto companies do you think have been launched successfully since Chrysler in like the 20s?
How do you define successfully?
Well, they're still in business. That's it. That's the only one. That's how hard it is to start a car company. And you can definitely make the case that Tesla's not successful.
If you look globally, though, if you looked at China, you've got...
Yeah, lots of China.
Lots of...
I'm talking about in the U.S.
Yeah.
In the U.S.
Well, we're a mature, saturated market.
All right, how are we going to do questions? Do we have a...
I have a question.
No, hold on a sec. I just want... Do we have a microphone? Oh, we need that mic.
It's not hot, but I'll let you figure it out.
Hello, hello. Okay.
Mark over there.
Lots of questions.
Right there.
Of course. If you were in the audience, you'd have a question.
Hmm?
If you were in the audience, you'd have a question.
So, I have two daughters, 13 and 16.
Well, actually, why don't we have the speakers identify themselves?
My name is Rocky Kistner. I'm a reporter. I'm a journalist. I've been here doing journalism for 30 years, and I care about the environment. I have two daughters, 13 and 16. They are beautiful girls. I worry about their future. And from what I've heard from you tonight, doesn't give me a lot of hope about the future. I said Tesla, and everybody laughed. That is not a joke. We are in a crisis. I think everybody here in this room understands that. And we depend on you, the automotive industry, to help find a sustainable future. So I ask you, who probably have daughters and sons, what are you doing about the future for our sons and daughters who are going to have to live in a world that is warming and being damaged by the automotive industry so far? I'm not trying to blame anyone, but I'm just looking for solutions. And I'm tired of hearing this stuff. Just answer it.
Well, I think that our job is to do all we can to encourage the spread of clean cars. I've written two books about it. I think that's what I've been trying to do in the last 25 years. But we also have to be... We have to be realistic, and our part of our job is to look at what the actual reality is on the ground and how it's going to develop. And, you know, I could say that, as some people do, we're going to have all electric cars in 2 or 3 years. I could say that. I wish it was true, but it isn't going to happen. We're not going to turn the Titanic around that quickly. You may want that to happen. I want it to happen. It's not going to happen.
So let me answer directly. I talked about the Bolt that we've already got in production. We also, as a company, have committed to bring out 20 all-electric models between now and 2023. So that's 20 models. Because one of the things we find when we talk to people about why aren't you buying electric vehicles is most people are committed to a certain type of vehicle. And they like electric vehicles, but they're not willing to change the kind of vehicle they buy to buy an electric vehicle. So with the 20 models, we will significantly expand the portfolio of vehicles that we'll be offering. And again, these are all completely electric, at least for GM. These are not hybrids or partially electric. They're zero emissions.
We have to do this with a microphone.
Let me make a point to that last question quickly. What I would say, you know, what is the future of the car going to be? In that regard, ultimately, it is what we as a society want it to be, and both, you know, as consumers and customers of profit-making companies, but as citizens who then ask to address these problems and then how it works out in our system. Unfortunately, we have a pretty darn broken system in the country at this point in terms of the social voice that needs to also be part of the process. But I would like to think that the pendulum swings. We've seen that. You know, we have today made incredible progress in cleaning up tailpipes. It was done by the engineers at General Motors and other companies, but it was done because we as a society passed a Clean Air Act. So I think it's, you know, we are all as a society ultimately going to choose what the car of the future is.
And I would just add, consumers don't choose electric vehicles. 0.6% of the cars sold last year were electric vehicles.
How much advertising? Excuse me, we're going to use the microphones.
Yeah, we are going to use the microphones.
I think we need to move on to the next question.
Yep.
Right. What I'd like to do, since I see there are a lot of people with questions, is can we line up here so that we go in an orderly fashion? And I want to remind people of the standard rules that we have at SEJ conferences, which is that journalists and students can also ask questions before anyone else. And the standard procedure is that you need to state your name and state your affiliation. So,
here you go. All right. So, real quick. We've seen attempts to rescind the...
You didn't say who you were.
Schlefstein Times Picayune, New Orleans. We've seen some attempts to rescind the CAFE standards or slow them down. and at the same time, similar sorts of reductions on greenhouse gases. The question is, what is that doing in terms of triggering what is happening in the auto industry? Is that assisting you guys in producing more efficient cars that reduce emissions, or is it hurting you?
Let's let Mike take that one.
Gee, I thought you'd say that. We get a little fixated in this country first on what we're doing here. John made the point earlier. China is pushing very aggressive electric vehicle standards. Europe is pushing very aggressive electric vehicle standards. Any global automaker is looking at having to convert a large part of their portfolio to electric vehicles, almost independent of what the U.S. is doing. I think Jim made the point earlier, there are more cars sold in China now than there are here in the U.S. And so we think about this move towards electrification as a global trend. It's going to happen. That's why we set the vision out to become a zero-emission company, and we're working towards that. And we'll see how things work their way through with the NPRM process here in this country.
Let me make a data-based remark about that last question. I did a calculation 2 years ago. I should update it soon. And as the economy recovered, you know, we had this big gas spike in 08 and then, you know, the economic meltdown. You know, as the economy recovered, you know, we saw significant market recovery, you know, in the auto market by about 2012 was well on its way, and gas prices were still high. They came down about 2 years later, they're creeping up again. Over the first 4 years of, you know, when the recovery was in full swing, and CAFE standards were ramping up, electric vehicle sales were ramping up, the shift back to light truck class vehicles, SUVs, picks up, and so on, put six times as much additional CO2 into the air on the new fleet as was saved by the electric vehicles that entered into the market at that period. So that, I think the question is right on. Electrification is not a panacea for the environment.
Hi, I'm Seema Mehta. I'm a reporter, a political reporter from the Los Angeles Times, and I'm studying automation and AI as a Knight Wallace Fellow at the University of Michigan. And the question I have for you is, and you sort of touched,
It is Mike, thank you.
I think you touched upon this. With automation, what do you see as the impact to the workforce? I mean, there are so many, you know, millions of Americans, particularly white American men without college degrees, who drive. And if we have a bunch of their jobs, you know, displaced, how do you see this impacting the workforce? And are there lessons that Detroit learned from, you know, when automation first struck the auto industry that we can apply now?
There were all sorts of visions of, you know, plants that would run completely without human beings. I think the key question as we talk about automated driving is what sort of skill sets do we move those people with training to anticipate the new jobs that will be created over and over with new technologies. We're very good at looking at what's going to be eliminated. We're not very good at anticipating what are the new jobs. What are the new autonomous service technician jobs that will be created? What are the new jobs that are created around running these massive fleets of vehicles in urban centers? There have been a couple of studies. There was one that we looked at that showed overall the positive impact of autonomous on the economy far outweighed the issues created by job dislocations. And so we should be able to take some of that economic creation and growth and use some part of that to help train the people for these future jobs.
Michelle, did you want to get in on this?
Well, one thought that I often think about is, you know, there's a shortage of truck drivers, long-haul truck drivers. Imagine if those trucks could be mostly automated, but the driver may, or at least automated at certain times of the day, certain stretches of the highway. Those people would still have jobs, but, you know, their jobs would be easier. They'll be different.
Hi, my name is Susie, and I'm a graduate student at the Berklee School of Journalism. And my question for you is, you said that General Motors is committed to putting 20 new makes of electric vehicles on the road by 2023. And my first question for you is, how likely is it that that's actually going to happen? And my second question is, have you committed also to reducing the number of high emission vehicles that you guys produce?
Well, so the first one, we're not a company that tends to say publicly things that we don't intend to do. When we come out and say 20 by 2023, in our future portfolio plan, we have specifically which models those are. Now, obviously, I'm not going to talk about, you know, our future product plan, specifically what models they are, but there are 20 vehicle programs underway that will be fully electrified vehicles by 2023. We're creating a whole new, completely electrified architecture.
So in a percentage chance that this is actually going to happen, 100% sure that these cars are going to be out?
I'm not going to say 100% because you never know what's going to happen in the world, but I can tell you that our current corporate portfolio plan will produce those 20 electrified vehicles by 2023. I'm sorry, your second question was?
About high emission vehicles.
So at the same time, and I think John's made this point, at the same time we're working away on electrification, we're also working at continuing to improve the ICE engine to make it better and better over time through a whole variety of technologies. So I think when you look at ICE engines, they have continued to improve. Now we see electrifying the fleet as the real step change, and that's why, honestly, we're not putting a lot of money into hybrids, because we see hybrids as a transitional state. We see electrified vehicles, zero emission vehicles, as where we want to get to. That's our vision, so that's what we're working on.
Thank you.
Hi, Derek Jackson, with the Union of Concerned Scientists and a former environmental writer on the editorial board of the Boston Globe. The vision, current vision of a, when you go by any car lot in America, still today, is one flooded with cars, the industry producing cars, to then sell, you know, I'm avoiding the word foist on the American public. So what is the business model? Do you see a change in the business model which is less about producing X amount of cars that you put on lots all over America to one that is more on, based on demand, actual demand of cars in terms of reducing congestion in this country?
Can I just say one thing about that? That there's a definite phenomena of a reduction in the number of dealerships in the U.S. because I think we're gradually switching to where people at least do their car shopping largely online. And that results in one of the things I'm going to be talking about in this book is the dealership model, the whole idea of having this lot full of cars, is that obsolete? There's some signs that it is. And with that, I'll let...
Yeah, that's exactly what I said. Is that model, in fact, obsolete? And it's in terms of congestion, in terms of whether a family actually needs another vehicle, et cetera, et cetera.
Ooh, where to start there? that model is struggling. I mean, the profits in dealerships are not there. The economics aren't working. The economics for the consumer aren't really working. There are a lot of people that are frozen out of the new car market by affordability. So those changing economics are going to force a change in the business models. Now, what those business models look like, it's not really clear. I mean, our clients are dealers, and they are all trying to figure out what's their future, what is their business model going to be. They may be the operators of mobility services. They may be the place that AVs go to charge up or get fixed or whatever. So the business model will change. We just don't know what that looks like yet.
Could I ask that people not talk at the back of the room, because it's pretty distracting?
My name is David Abel. I'm a reporter at the Boston Globe. This question was alluded to earlier. I just want to put a finer point on it. The Trump administration's efforts to gut the auto emissions standards or fuel efficiency standards that were set during the Obama administration have been aggressively lobbied for on behalf of many of the auto companies. And I'm wondering whether GM has been a part of that lobbying effort to try to gut these fuel efficiency standards, and in light of your mission to reduce emissions to zero, how does that comport, and why in the world would GM do that?
What we have been consistently saying we would like to see is one national standard, and a look at the standard to examine the potential impacts of all these technologies we've been talking about tonight. So, for instance, if I deploy an electric vehicle into one of these high-utilization ride-sharing fleets, we know from our data it's driven about 3 times further per day than the typical retail vehicle.
Okay, I got it.
We would like to see a way that helps encourage deployment of electric vehicles where they're going to do the most good for the environment the most quickly.
I've been encouraged to wrap things up, so I'm going to let the people who are standing there now ask very quick questions, and we'll give you very quick answers.
Just a quick follow-up.
No, I'm telling you, you've already asked the questions, so let's move on.
Hi, I'm Francis. I just walked in off the street. I am curious about the ecosystem of the auto industry, specifically just thinking about auto insurers and labor unions and
can you just make it a real quick question?
Yeah, I'm just that's just the question is like what are your thoughts as you reconceptualize the auto industry with respect to auto insurers and labor unions?
Hi, I'm Kara Dwin. I'm a freelance journalist. As we know, the type of vehicle that people buy is very entangled with their identity in terms of politics and things, and like electric vehicles are considered leftist, hippie type of things. What is the automotive industry doing to combat this, and what can journalists do?
Sorry, just since people are getting a little restless, just to let you know, we have 2 shuttles that are going to be waiting outside to go to the airports. So if you hang on for about 10 minutes, we wrap up. I'm sorry, to the hotel. Thank you. The hotels. It's the airport hotel. So the first one will go to the Holiday Inn Express first, and then the airport hotels. So don't worry. The buses are here and waiting, so we can finish this up and everybody be happy.
Yep. Very sorry.
I forgot the question already.
you did ask, what could journalists do to help? So we're trying to expand the portfolio of electric vehicles considerably. We're not building those vehicles. We want people to buy those vehicles. The second part of your question, though, I think is important. The surveys I see that at least 50% of Americans don't understand anything about electric vehicles. And so there's still a huge education task, I think, ahead of us. And I think some of the folks in this room can help with that.
I second that. I think there's a big job that has to be done about educating consumers.
I have an important nuance on that. I think that there has been an overemphasis on trying to sell electric vehicles. Been pushing a wet noodle up a hill. Electrification is a great technology, but if you are concerned about the environment, and this, I think, is not so much a failure of the auto industry per se, except perhaps through their lobbying, but a failure on the part of the interested public, the environmental community, and government to not educate people who have environmental values. I run the U of M Energy Survey. We see the signal that people express environmental values very strongly when you ask them general questions about it. People do not connect their personal environmental values to their a major purchase decision that is perhaps one of the largest impacts on the environment. They do not connect the dots. And that is a huge and important gap that is much broader than electrification. And I'm worried that an overfixation on electrification as the panacea solution is limiting our collective ability to actually help GM sell more efficient Silverados and Tahoes and all these other things.
Following up on what John is saying, one of the issues right now is overall green car sales are not growing that much, even while electric car sales are growing. What's shrinking is hybrid sales because people are moving from their hybrids to their electrics. What we really need to do is to get people out of the biggest SUVs, the biggest gas guzzlers, into electric cars. That shift hasn't happened yet. We need to work on that. That's important.
Well, I think that's a mistake. I think that the thing is, all cars, especially the high volume, you have multiple choices in powertrain and features that are going to vary by a few MPG. And so the shift, you're not going to, you know, I have a hybrid and I have a Silverado. You're never going to get me anytime soon to replace my Silverado, which I actually use for hauling mulch and stuff like that.
It would be taken out of your
But I would love to have had the choice of a more efficient Silverado. I did buy the most efficient. I got the Silverado because it was more efficient than the Ram and the F-150 at the time. But most people don't make decisions that way. That's the need. It's not trying to put the Tahoe drivers into Bolts. I'm sorry, that's silly.
That's by the way, look, subscription service works well because you can swap out of different vehicles. You'd only have the Silverado when you absolutely needed it, and then you could drive an electric car.
That would be helpful also, but you've got to get that value expressed.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the new
Silverado.
All right,
Silverado did you want to ask a question because you were the last one?
Yeah. I'll be real quick. I'm Chris Kick. I write for something called Farm and Dairy newspaper in Northeast Ohio. And I'm seeing even among the farmers a lot of interest in alternatives, but they flat out have to have the power to get the job done. So if they need to haul livestock or whatever, you know, they need the power and the, but they've adapted to, you know, greater tier efficiencies with their trucks and their emissions and their tractors and different things, but power and performance are still just big issues. But I really appreciated your guys' talk on cars in general and where you see things headed.
All right, that's more a statement than a question. So,
but it's a nice statement.
if you have the last question.
Sorry for keeping you guys so long. I was told to ask questions. And I'm a student at the University of Michigan. I'm 21. I'm a senior in the public health school. I'm taught every day about incentivizing behavior change. And I don't know, we constantly face the struggle and the challenge of getting people to sustain healthy behaviors. And in this case, maybe Maven car sharing is a healthy behavior. And Ann Arbor is the first place that Maven was placed on Google.
It was, thank
yes.
you.
Yes, and yes, I'm educated on climate change and the healthy environment. I'm from New York City, I understand. But I'm not like the typical consumer, right? I'm not the normal person. I don't even participate in Maven sharing, and I understand the benefits of it. What are those incentives to get people to switch to use that?
All right. Does anyone want to give last answer?
So I think what we anticipate is as we move into these sharing fleets, the cost per mile is actually going to start falling pretty sharply, and that will happen because the most expensive technologies on the vehicles are silicon-based technologies. They'll follow some form of Moore's law. As the price per mile goes down, we think that'll incent people to do the right thing, and if they're electric vehicles, then you're in a way you're changing behavior to have people use electric vehicles more often.
Economics and enhancing their lives. I mean, is it enhancing their lives because they're environmentally conscious? They want better safety. They just don't want to drive, you know, with autonomous vehicles. I think those are the keys.
All right. With that, I want to thank our panelists. Why don't you join me in thanking our panelists, Mike Abelson from General Motors, John DeChico from the University of Michigan, and Michelle Krebs from Cox. Thank you.